Onassis Foundation. Dublab.
Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis LA and Dublab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hi, Derica. This is Alex Vitale calling for Quarantine Tapes, hosted by Paul Holdengraber and supported by Onassis LA and Dublab. I'm so glad you were able to take my call.
Yes. Hi, Alex. How are you doing?
I'm really well, and I'm super excited that you're in the process of moving to New York City. I know you actually moved around quite a bit during the pandemic, including spending some time in your hometown of St. Louis, where I know your mother was ill. St. Louis has become, I think, such an interesting place in terms of not just the initial uprising in Ferguson, but a lot of really important political developments there, including the Close the Workhouse campaign, the recent election of Tashwara Jones to be mayor. So what's going on in St. Louis?
Well, St. Louis is just really an incredible place. And I'm actually a bit jealous that I don't get to spend more time back home. Every time I go home, there's a new exciting campaign, either by Arch City Defenders or Action St. Louis. And so since the uprising, a lot of organizations that had been there either found themselves with a resurgence of energy and excitement around changing the political, cultural, organizational landscape there. And other organizations just form and blossom. And so we're seeing so many campaigns around sex workers, around trans rights, around closing the workhouse, which is a jail that is, I mean, all jails are horrible. The workhouse, you know, it has a shared history with lots of other workhouses across the country. Some of them held slaves, runaways, people who were too poor to be released into society, so they had to pay their debts by doing labor. And so there's been this campaign for several years to close it down. And there was a commitment by the newly elected mayor, Tashwara Jones, to fully close the institution. So that was a major campaign victory for Access St. Louis and for Arch City Defenders both there. So I think they've been able to sustain real organizing because they have been able to do traditional organizing work. You know, they knock on doors, they bail people out, they regularly canvass, they have community-based meetings, community town halls, they solicit feedback, they throw events. And in a world where so much is privileged from what you see online, several groups in St. Louis have been doing the hard day-to-day work of connecting people and have been showing them alternative ways that we could be free. I think that's exciting.
One of the things that really impressed me right away about the Close the Workhouse campaign was that rather than just conceptualizing it as getting people out of jail, they also understood that we need to address the conditions that are leading people to end up incarcerated in the first place, so that we need to create new infrastructures to support people so they can live more freely, not just to be free of incarceration, but to be free of housing insecurity, to be free of poverty, to be free of, you know, health conditions that aren't adequately treated.
Yes, yes. I think that's incredible. When you look at the Close the Workhouse report, that was a project, or I guess a report created by Arch City Action Advancement Project, and I think the local chapter of the Bell Project. I think when you look and see the median income of people in St. Louis, especially Black people who are disproportionately represented in the workhouse population, I mean, there's so much inequality that drives incarceration, that drives policing, that drives violence. And I think it's incredible that these organizers and lawyers are trying to figure out how to reduce the inequality and how to reduce the carceral state and shrink its footprint on that city. And so, yes, absolutely. Healthcare, jobs, housing, access to fresh foods. There's a new organization I believe it's called the Freedom Community Center, FCC, and it's ran by, was founded and currently run by a former member of the Close the Workhouse campaign, Mike Milton. And what Mike is doing is taking this neighborhood-based assessment of what people need in order to thrive in the areas of St. Louis that are most dispossessed and have the highest rates of crime. And he's trying to figure out how to be responsive through street violence interruption, community-based care services, diversion from the criminal courts. And so when you have organizers who are committed to doing these community-based projects to reduce the carceral state and to meet people's needs, it just is ripe for potential for actual liberation.
Well, I've had a few opportunities to go out there and have been just incredibly impressed at the level of grassroots organizing that's going on there. I have to say, I was so thrilled to get an advanced peek at your new book, Becoming Abolitionists, which I think is just tremendous. It's going to be, I think, a game changer for the conversation. And I really loved that you expressed the title in the plural form, abolitionists, because the book is a memoir, but you're also seem to be telling more of a collective tale here. And so over the last few years, you know, we've seen a growing number of individuals and organizations moving away from a framework around policing that's rooted in reform or in, you know, retribution towards this kind of abolitionist framework that you write about so eloquently. And so I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about your own journey through that process and why you thought of it in this plural form.
Yeah, I love that question. And I've also have been so resistant to calling the book a memoir. And so when you're like, I think the second person who said that, and I was like, oh, is this a memoir? I'm so confused. The first part, I think, starts to read as definitely memoir because it talks about how I grew up and how I was politicized. And the reason that I initially wrote the book that way is because whenever I would get pushback from lawyers or policy people or criminal justice reformers, they would say, survivors don't want this, or you don't know what it's like to live in a dangerous neighborhood, or you need to go on a police ride along, or you don't understand. This is, you know, abolition is just going to leave all of these poor Black women dangerous across the country. And it will be so frustrating because so many people that I know who pushed me to become abolitionists were poor Black women who were survivors of violence. And so I tried to make an intervention from that particular way. And just show that, no, it's not the case that abolition is an academic exercise or it only belongs, you know, in the hands of people who are white and progressive and who live in places where there's low crime rates. Like, there's a huge spread of people who consider themselves abolitionists. And I was just hopefully trying to showcase a little bit about where I come from. So it wasn't connected to that critique of abolition that's so frustrating and just honestly inaccurate. So that's one reason why I told the story that way, starting with my neighborhood in St. Louis and giving a bit of the history of how it became dispossessed and disenfranchised, and really just using capitalism and other things that cause inequality like homophobia, racism, ableism to paint a picture of how the police are then sent to respond to the manifestation of all of these problems, which are rooted in exploitation and extraction and exclusion, right? Instead of democracy and love and community, right? And so I think that's why I took that particular angle and why it may read initially like a memoir before it shifts a bit. And then the reason I decided to write it plural is because one thing I've also have noticed in response to the recent mainstreaming of abolition is that there are so many people who have been called like experts, like abolitionist experts. And a lot of these people are my friends and my comrades. It happens to me. But I remember a point where we were demanding more diverse police departments. I remember when we were hopeful around more body cameras, more training. And what I tried to do was tell a piece of the story about the generation of organizers who actually became partially politicized by trying to get someone arrested, right? Trying to get George Zimmerman arrested. And how so many people who were in that generation of organizers, through study, through further campaigns, through intellectual debate, through experimentation and risk, ultimately evolved to adopt more radical, more beautiful sets of politics, including abolition, including socialism, including analyses around internationalism, right? And so I include stories from these other people and glimpses of their own journey just to give offer some relief, I guess, to some people who may think that people who are espousing abolitionist politics either haven't actually tried reform, or we, you know, have all of the answers, when it's like, no, we don't. It's actually through struggle. It's been a decade long struggle for me and decades long struggle for other people to come to these sets of politics.
Yeah, people want to know in the space of a tweet, well, what are you going to do instead?
Exactly. Exactly.
It's so frustrating, too often an unwillingness to actually read anything, or much less engage in collective struggle around these issues. They just want to lob these little bombs from the outside at folks.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure you've had to deal with your share of hate mail and that kind of thing as well.
Yeah, it's part of it is very, very sad and frustrating to know that some people would take time out of their day either to find my address or to find my email address and to send me an email just suggesting that I don't know or that I don't care about survivors when, as I detail in the book, I'm a survivor of so many different types of harm and violence, and just being a survivor is not enough to then go and inform your political analysis, right? It's how you make sense of the things that you survived. So that's frustrating. But I think what I've been most excited about is the amount of people who I think are abolition curious or fence sitters, who I actually have conversations with, who I struggle with, who I meet in my community, my neighbors, those people who I would say have gone from being, what are you even talking about, to, okay, maybe we deserve something else. And I think that's been incredibly rewarding.
After the police killing of Freddie Gray in Baltimore, there was this brief moment when the local prosecutor there, Marilyn Mosby, was celebrated for bringing charges against several of the officers responsible for his death. In the end, though, that's not who ended up in prison, as you point out in the book. What was the ultimate outcome, and what does that tell us about the possibility of obtaining justice from these kinds of progressive prosecutors or just the criminal legal system more broadly?
So I really dislike the phrase progressive prosecutor because it's essentially meaningless. A prosecutor, overall, a prosecutor puts people in prison. That's what prosecutors do. And so progressive prosecutor has become such a silver bullet in the criminal legal reform movement because lawyers especially identify prosecutors as having the most power in terms of the fate of the people who are so vulnerable in society. And so to be a progressive prosecutor, there's this assumption that you're going to do and act in the best interest of the people who were, like I explained, the most vulnerable. But the problem with the idea of a progressive prosecutor is that there's no real metric. There's no serious metric about what it means to be progressive. It's not how many people you free every year. It's not how many people you cage. It's not the length of sentences have increased, not the length of sentences have decreased. There's no serious metric. And so anyone can kind of be progressive. Kamala Harris can brag about putting poor Black mothers in prison because of their children's absenteeism, right? And then she gets to run as president at one point by saying she's a progressive prosecutor. So the bar is all over the place. It's neither high or low. So ultimately with Marilyn Mosby, and I remember that moment very, very clearly because I was in Baltimore helping with the protest as a legal observer. And when she announced that she was bringing charges, I remember crying with my friends out of excitement and thankfulness. I praise God. I was like, oh, wow, this is exactly what we need. All of these other prosecutors are cowards. We need more progressive Black women in position. And ultimately, all of those charges against those cops are dropped. And the people who spent the most amount of time in jail were the protesters who were defying the curfews in order to make a stand to get those cops arrested in the first place. And that's true generally. There's been more protesters, more Black people who spend time in prison and in jail for protests of police violence than the police who's actually been violent. And so I don't think there's a tremendous possibility for justice from people we traditionally call progressive prosecutors. I do think that people are experimenting with different ways to try to get as many people free from the system. So sometimes I'll see or even support some campaigns that are trying to figure out, should we run a prosecutor who's been a defense attorney? But I still refuse to call these people progressive.
I love the sort of lovely literary references throughout the book, both fiction and nonfiction. And I was really struck by some references to Teju Cole's essays, and it prompted me to go out and read some more of them. I'd seen a few, and you referenced this essay he wrote about Baldwin, where he goes back to the same Swiss village where Baldwin was when he was working on Go Tell It on the Mountain. Mm-hmm. And in there, he evokes this idea of the Black body, and you riff off that to talk about this idea of dehumanization and push back against this language by sort of arguing that we need to not give up this idea that our humanity can be taken away from us. And yeah. I thought that was very powerful, but it felt a little different to me than the way Ta-Nehisi Coates talks about the Black body, which I found to be less hopeful in a sense. And do you feel that tension as well?
Well, how can I explain this? I think in some ways I felt that tension early on. And so when I was politicized or being politicized rather around police violence and police killings, I found myself repeating this language of dehumanization quite uncritically. And I remember when Between the World and Me came out, I was at a conference, at a Law for Black Lives conference at Riverside. And I was at this table full of Black law students, and we all literally pulled out Between the World and Me. First of all, because the writing is just incredible. And it was written in a Baldwinian fashion as a letter to his son. And we were all just floored. It was like, wow, here's someone writing like to speak to sort of this movement. And I remember being moved by deep, deep, deep pieces in the book. But I noticed that as I continued to use the language of dehumanization, I just wonder why we were conceding or giving away so much power to police or to white people who could kill us, right? It seemed that the dehumanization was sort of a stand-in for something I think was actually needed, which was a power analysis. And so, I love Stokely Carmichael's quote, which is, now then, in order to understand white supremacy, we must dismiss the fallacious notion that white people can give anyone their freedom. Right. So it's like drawing on that tradition of, well, we know we can't rely on groups of people to give us our freedom. Freedom is something that we should have inherently, that we struggle for, that we fight to protect. Then why is it that we give power to police and to these institutions to dehumanize us, to remove it? And then I came across this essay by Walter Johnson that just spoke so deeply to what I have been struggling with over time. And Walter, he uses it in the context of slavery, right? So he's arguing against historians who said slavery dehumanized all these Black people. And he asks very simple questions like, you know, if slavery or slave masters or slave owners dehumanized Black people, could you ever regain your humanity again? What's the metric? What's the basis to remove someone away? And so I've noticed that the dehumanization aspect has been so overbrought, because then the response to dehumanization then is to humanize someone. And I fear that humanization also obscures the power analysis and the power dynamics between the institutions that exploit us. So for example, if you think the problem, if you think that cops dehumanize Black kids, and I think this is the example I give in the book, and the problem is that they don't see them as human, then you may be committed to investing resources in youth programs so that cops can then see those kids as humans, right? Instead of asking, why should police be in the presence or doing this particular job in the first place? And so I was nervous that humanization was actually connected to deep sets of reforms that continue to give more resources to police, because you're trying to humanize, you're trying to build relationships, you're trying to get them to see each other as two sides of the same types of communities who are committed to living together in harmony. And that's not what police do, right? That's not what prisons do. I'm again finding myself struggling with the movement around prisons and people who are trying to use reform and say we need to use humanizing language to describe people who are held captive by the state. And it's like, absolutely, we need to see those people as human. I'm also nervous that if we don't recognize them as being prisoners, then we don't understand the urgency for their release. And so I'm still working through a lot of these concepts and constantly being pushed, but my deepest fear is that we're going to attempt to humanize people and ultimately give more resources to the carceral state that exploits them regardless.
Yes, and threatens their bodies and their minds. Yes. This reminds me too of a striking fact in the book related to this, you know, this discourse around police reform, which is that every time there's a high profile police killing of someone, that stock in the company Axon, which makes body cameras, goes up. So that Axon has become a repository of response to these acts of injustice. How do you think about that in relationship to this idea that we're going to fix policing through technology?
Well, we absolutely cannot fix policing through technology, and especially under capitalism, because then people are just simply benefiting from police violence. And so every time there's a police killer, as you said, Axon, I think which used to be Taser, and they just went through a full rebranding process so that people would associate them with being on the side of reform. But then when you look at the boardroom notes, they also are excited about new potential technologies because it's an opportunity for them to make money. They say, you know, this could be a $1 billion industry. We have cops who kill, you know, about 3 people a day, about 1,000 people a year in the U.S. We also have, just immeasurable police violence, police presences, police violence, and this could be a market that we can tap into. And so I'm especially nervous if we don't understand how capitalism and investments and returns impact, you know, what reform looks like, then we can just keep falling back on these simplistic singular responses to violence from police that doesn't take into account the fuller picture, right? And so I think that we have that language around the prison industrial complex. There's been enough organizing and media narratives around private prisons and Sodexo and which telecommunications company are benefiting from exorbitant prices to make calls to your loved ones. I think there's been sufficient narratives around that for the prisons. I think obviously there always could be more. I also think that there is enough critique around war and the military industrial complex and how every time we're in war, it's profitable. We know that from Gil Scott-Heron, which is why we don't have peace, because peace is too cheap. And so we have some of these analyses of war. We know that Blackwater, I guess, and all of these other private contracting companies, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, all of these companies are going to benefit when we enter war. But yeah, with police, it's like, let's go to technology, that would save us. And it's like, no, this is part of the same system, right? Police are part of the prison industrial complex, and we're going to see companies benefit from the violence that they have. So we need to reduce our reliance. If there's going to be any cameras, it should be probably coming from the people who are recording the interactions, because we have most control of that. So more cop watch, less body cameras.
Yeah, the same people who say, well, we couldn't possibly get out of Afghanistan, you know, are the same people saying we couldn't possibly defund the police.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of neoconservative worldview that says, you know, the solution to all our problems is violence and coercion. And this you know, evokes for me Ruth Wilson Gilmore's work, who I know has been a big influence on both of us. And she says that, you know, this discourse around abolition is not a negative discourse, right? People think, oh, this is just a vengeful attack on the police that's going to leave us open to chaos. But actually, it's a discourse around creation, around presence, around hopefulness, around building something positive. So what are some of the positive things you think that we need to build out of this movement that are going to create a better world for us?
I think what's so exciting about what Ruthie says in the creation on negation, it just means that there's so many opportunities for us to decide what that is, right? And I give some examples of what I was dreaming about at the time when I wrote the book. But I think that if we're going to undermine the carceral state, abolitionists, I know at least, the ones that I know, the ones I organize with, we also see ourselves committed to undermining the kinds of society that could have police, which simply means also committed to undermining harm. And so I see a lot of organizations that have sprung up just in the last year and a half, who's been committed to fighting police violence, fighting prison violence, ending both of those kinds of violence, but also fighting against patriarchy, and misogyny, right? I'm thinking about Black Man Build, Phil Agnew's organization that has so many new chapters around the country trying to get Black men to eliminate and fight patriarchy and misogyny and capitalism. I think that's incredible. I think about some of the campaigns I see that come from inside outside organizing. So trying to make sure that people who are currently inside get access to food, access to healthcare, access to proper medical treatment under the pandemic. And I also see them trying to force the release of people who've been incarcerated, right? And so I'm thinking about organizations who've been doing anti-eviction work, the Kansas City Tenants Unions, who are trying to make sure, and Tenant Workers United. I'm thinking of so many groups now who are doing incredible work to build the kind of society that we want. And so, yes, evictions are a problem. And it's not simply enough to have moratoriums against evictions, even though that they're important. I think it's also important to look at the work of these tenant unions who are trying to organize and build collective power against landlords in the meantime, so that tenants can have more power to then organize and improve their conditions until we have a society where people can have more stewardship over property and less ownership over property. I think about all the beautiful art campaigns that push people to imagine other ways of being in the world, which I actually think is very, very difficult and risky to put yourself out there to say, I think the world should be like this, and then to be committed to go and experiment with it. So I'm grateful for a lot of art collectives that experiment with that. Decrim campaigns, especially around sex work. I'm thinking about Decrim in DC and BYP100's work. I think their work around sex work is so, so important because it shakes up the taboo around what sex work means, which then can actually lead to less violence against sex workers. It can also push us towards a society where people, if they engage in sex work, it's because they're interested or they're curious or they're good at it or they're bored, and not because they're hungry, they've been locked out of employment, they've been kicked out of their homes. And so the language and organizing that Decrim sex work campaigns do shift the terrain for what's possible in our relationships. I love the work that I follow a bunch of these Instagram pages around different relationships that are non-monogamous, which I think is very, very specific, but very, very, very important, because I watch these people who put out this literature challenge what it means to be in nuclear families and nuclear relationships. And that's important because one of the main reasons why people get killed is because their partner wants to control their sexuality. They want to control their relationships. There is a control over who women sleep with and who women get to be attracted to. And so unless we attack or at least undermine sort of heteronormative ideas about families and relationships, we won't be able to then undermine the kinds of violence that comes typically from men, not always, but typically from men, and trying to prevent women through jealousy and control. So those pages I think are interesting because they're doing a fascinating level of cultural work that I think could actually save lives. And so I think the possibilities are endless. I'd even talk about disability justice and climate justice, people who are making sure that spaces are not only accessible but interdependent. I mean, there's just so many beautiful examples of different ways that people to plug in and work that I don't even know they'll realize is abolitionist, but it can be if we commit to doing it towards undermining the carceral state as a solution to our problems.
Yeah, we don't have to get people to mouth certain keywords to consider them to be part of this movement. It's not about some kind of symbolic litmus test. It's really who's doing the work of trying to create a more just society where people have housing security and income security and health security, which, you know, our current system does everything it can to deny people.
Yes, to deny some people so that other people can have much easier access to it.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Well, Derica, it was so lovely to catch up with you. And I wish you all the most wonderful luck with the new book. I think it's going to be a tremendous hit. And I look forward to seeing you in person before too much longer.
Yes, me too, Alex. Thank you for this. This is great.
To support this show and Dublab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.